My name is Mike McCafferty. I just want to talk about Star Trek Beyond. Beyond.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
You're in the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate. But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
And it's real!
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
Podcast. Sorry, I thought you'd left after the opening credits. I'm Mike McCafferty here, and I'm just playing a little bit of First Contact. See, I'm going off later on tomorrow to the Las Vegas convention and Star Trek convention, and my friend Ryan Nagata, friend of the podcast, wants me to play this. And I'm not very good at it. But he still wants me to play it. But I love playing it. Let me come over here. Because this was actually part of a... Well, it's part of a point I'm trying to make. There we go. It's always good when you use different things to make your point in a podcast. Because sometimes podcasts become a little boring, a little bit stagnant, can't they? But I was over there at my keyboard there, my very loud, clicky keyboard, here in my office... my garage office, which I'm going to call Space Station Regula 2 right now. We weren't working on Genesis. We were working on Deuteronomy. That's another project that Carol Marcus was working on. No, but I'm over there and I'm playing for a reason. It's sort of an analogous situation there. Because I'm still recovering from Comic-Con. My voice has still been shot for the past like week. And I've been trying to make that recover because I'm going to go off to now the third part, my troika of amazing things I'm doing here for Star Trek this year of Star Trek. I went off to Riverside, Iowa, went to Comic-Con, and now tomorrow morning I'm heading off to the Star Trek Vegas convention, which I've been there before. You know about all this stuff. I don't have to tell you this stuff, but I'm going to tell you. But the reason I'm playing this music, besides the fact, is that Ryan wants me to play it when he's putting it in his own video, where he's going to show some props being made or stuff like that. He's got some really, really great costumes this year. I'll try to put them up on the Facebook website. Go to I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek Facebook page. If you haven't, I'm posting all sorts of weird, cool stuff. I put this really cool video about the restoration of one of the original USS Enterprise models from the original Star Trek. They spent about a year on this, and it's a 6-minute video, and it's totally worth your time if you love Star Trek. And it now proudly sits in the Smithsonian. It used to be like downstairs in the gift shop, kind of tucked away, and now it is proudly displayed for all to see, because it's more than just a television prop. It became like a beacon for scientists, for people who want to become scientists or pilots, who want to become involved in Star Trek. So check that out. So I'm digressing. I was playing that song because for the past week, as I've been recovering, I wanted to do my Star Trek Beyond review, and I wanted to do it right. I had to do it right for you people who take the time to listen to me be a jackass sometimes and talk about Star Trek, because that's all I want to talk about right now. But I wanted to do it right. I wanted to get everything perfect. I wanted to see it. I wanted to see Beyond again. I wanted to write a bunch of notes. I wanted to come up with something pithy and interesting to say, some sort of insightful ideas about it. But then I kind of let that go. First of all, I didn't get a chance to see the movie, so there we are. That's on me. But then I realized that it doesn't matter how definitive my review of this movie is going to be, because that'll change and change and change and change throughout the years. Much like the way when you play a song, you play it differently every time. You hear it differently every time. Do you understand what I'm doing here? I'm doing some really, really cool stuff here. with metaphor and analogy and paradigm. I'm not sure if that doesn't work. That doesn't matter. I'll cut that out. But I kind of cast that aside. I kind of jettisoned. I kind of went to the escape pod on the idea I was going to do a perfect review of Star Trek Beyond, because it's been over a week. It's been 10 days now. We need to talk about it, don't we? We need to talk about it. You've seen it by now, haven't you? You have to have seen it. If you haven't seen it, you have to go see it. I'm giving you permission. Go see it right now. Stop the podcast. Go see it. Come back and listen to this. I'm going to spoil some stuff for you. But we have to talk about it. And so let's dive into it. Let's talk about Star Trek Beyond, shall we? What did you think about it? I don't have time to wait for that. I'm going to tell you what I thought about it. I liked it. I liked it a lot. The end. No, let's talk more about it. I thought they got a lot more right than they got wrong this time, which I don't think you can say for Into Darkness. I don't think you can say that. And I'm not the only person who thinks that. I asked my friends on Facebook. I said, tell me what you think about it. And I have 17 reviews. And so far, there looks like there's out of the 17, 15 like it, 3 to 4 stars, and 2 hate it. Ryan Nagata, friend of the podcast. My friend Tyler Spears doesn't like it very much. Oh, Kim Miller doesn't like it. She gave it 2.5 stars. No big deal. So we might have to talk to her a little bit later on. But by and large, people like it. One of the best of the 3 Kelvinverse movies, says David Michelson. Aaron Moles, better than Star Trek Into Darkness. Hear, hear. Michael Krupe saw it, enjoyed it, but liked last one better. I have him do a 6-word review on this. I don't have time for big, wordy reviews here. That's my department. Cheryl Johnson, 4 stars. Tony Caselli, friend of the podcast. Best Star Trek movie since First Contact. I may agree with that. They go on, but we need to go on. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the show. So, as I said before, I gave you sort of like a light review. And one of the reasons I wanted to come back and review it again, I'm still going to have to see it. And when I do that, I may do another mini review again after I've seen it in a movie theater. Because the time I saw it, I saw it outdoors. In conditions that were both ideal and not ideal. We had a full orchestra playing it. IMAX screen. 3,000 fans of Star Trek cheering every single moment. But it's not the way we're going to see it from this point out. My next best opportunity is to see it in an IMAX theater with a regular crowd. And then after that, on DVD or on Netflix or some sort of streaming way of seeing these things. But I'm not going to see it like that. I'm not going to see it with 3,000 people who love Star Trek as much as I do. Not as much, a little less. They love it a little less than I do. No one loves it as much as I do. I'm sorry. They just don't. But anyways, let's get into it. Here we go. My third time I'm telling you we're going to get into it, and now we're going to get into it. I have notes. I have some notes here. They're poorly crafted, and I can't find it right now. Ah, here we go. No, here we go. Here we go. Notes. I have the word story written down. I don't know what that means. I have the word smaller story written down. And in some ways, this story feels a little bit smaller. It's not about the fate of the universe or the Federation. Eventually, the Federation becomes something, it becomes more about the Federation. But by and large, this story felt smaller, more compact, and that wasn't a bad thing. That's actually pretty good, I think. I think they bit off a little more than they can chew in the first two, because in both of those, the Earth was in peril. Automatically, the Earth and the Enterprise and everything around it was instantly in peril. The whole universe, the whole timeline was in peril in the first one. Earth, ostensibly, was in peril. San Francisco, war with the Klingons, who knows what was going on in the second one. In this one, it was more about the crew. The crew was in peril. And then it became about the Yorktown, and then it became about the Federation, all sort of stuff. That's fine. You are permitted to, oh my God, there's a giant cockroach on my wall right now. Oh God, I've got to go kill it. I'm sorry. It's huge. I have to, it's climbing on the wall. Ugh. I hate these guys. Oh God, no. Okay. Sorry about that, but every once in a while we have visitors here in the garage in Space Station Regular 2. They come in and that guy was giant and he was on the wall and I can't abide by that. I'm sorry, I can't. I've warned them. I've tried to sway them away. I have little poison traps all over the place. That guy, he didn't make it. I'm sorry. But this episode did. This one did make it, didn't it? We start off with a kind of a fun teaser, don't we? That's a fun teaser. It even fooled me. I thought, oh, there's these giant aliens. Okay, they're going to wrestle with Kirk, all this sort of stuff. He has this weird device. And they turn out to be little small guys. Funny. I like the last two episodes. They've made them very funny little Indiana Jones, James Bond kind of openings. Those are good. Those are good. Those are a good way to start off. You know, you do a little bit of a misdirect with us. Keep us on our toes. So that we are expecting something grand, aren't we? Every single movie now the stakes have to be higher than they were before. Everything has to be put on the line. And so why not start out with something that's a little less? So something that sort of misdirects us and puts us a little more at ease. This is going to be fun. This will be a fun little jaunt here. We can have a little fun little side quest here. Now, ultimately, this actually tails into the actual story, which is nice. But it sets the initial tone of what's beyond. What is beyond? And what does this title mean, beyond? I don't 100% understand. I guess it's beyond what we know. You know, in improv, Viola Spolin, who was kind of the progenitor of improv, I know I'm deviating here, but she would always ask in a scene, what's beyond? What's beyond? Meaning that, okay, you've reached your limit. Now go a little bit further. And maybe that's what they're saying here. What's beyond? I don't know if this movie actually went beyond. I think they went further than they've gone before, which is basically Earth-centric stories. They haven't really, you know, I mean, I know they went to Klingon homeworld and all that sort of stuff, but then they came back. Most of them have been set, the past have been set in and around Earth. But this is the first one that does go beyond. And the thing that I loved about this movie, beyond that first trailer, that first little teaser, was that then we had the captain's log. We're settling into the third year of a 5-year mission. And, you know, even in the TV show, you know, they were in year 3 of a 5-year mission. But those were only 76 incidents, 76 days. I know there's a couple of them where they had more of a passage of time. I think it's the Paradise Syndrome, where Kirk was on the planet for like 3 months. But putting that aside, you know, if every day, every episode was a day, what's in between? Maybe this movie should have been called Star Trek Between, right? Right? What's between the excitement? And that's the tedium, the monotony. I love the scene where Kirk opens up his dresser and there's nothing but yellow shirts. That's what you wear. Although in the original series, he wore the green tunic as well. So I'm just saying, he should have had that one kind of on the side. That's okay, because in the Kelvin universe, when Nero attacked, Starfleet decided that the green tunic was not appropriate. Maybe, I don't know. That doesn't make a lot of sense. That's okay. We don't need to worry too much about that. We also start out with something we haven't really gotten to before, which is Leonard McCoy, Dr. McCoy, Bones, talking to Kirk. And really talking, not just providing exposition or moving the plot longer or oh God, no, there's cats outside. Man, this place is a menagerie, but not the good kind, not the good Star Trek kind. It's filled with all sorts of giant, I guess you call them June bugs. I don't want to say cockroaches, but I mean, you know, they're so gigantic. Like monsters, like giant hordas that come into my house, into my garage, Space Station Regular 2. I thought I had that fixed. Ugh. There's dogs, and there's cats, and there's all sorts of insects in here. Part of my 5-year mission. But what they don't have is Dr. McCoy talking to James T. Kirk and really having a discussion. They're having a drink after a long day, after a long mission, maybe a tedious mission. And they're just hanging out, and they're getting, you know, they're just talking about what's going on and, you know, what's been happening. And I can't remember if this is where it is, but Kirk sort of lets slip that he might be applying for the Vice Admiral spot. Admiral Kirk. Kind of a tease into the Prime universe. That's great. I don't mind it one bit. They also let slip that Kirk's birthday's coming up. Again, we're starting, we're actually making better connections to Star Trek II in this movie than we did in the second movie, in Into Darkness, which was supposed to be the Khan movie. This one did a better job. It slipped it in there very subtly. This was another birthday scene. McCoy and Kirk have that great birthday scene in Star Trek II. This is a pretty good one. It's not as good as that one because the stakes are not as high. This is more about transition from Kirk going from captain to vice admiral. And in Star Trek II, it's more about Kirk trying to figure out who he is in life, much as I have been trying to do this whole year. But it's a good start to the film. I'm liking where this is going. And to release Carl Urban, release the Carl Urban, and have him finally act and finally become Dr. McCoy, so wonderful. We'll have him pop in more and more throughout this movie. It's such a welcome change from the normal dynamic. Now, the normal dynamic, we talked about this a little bit before in these Kelvin universes, is they've replaced Dr. McCoy, which was sort of the humanist standpoint. You know, always think about humanity, always think about the morals of a situation, and they replaced it with Uhura. So originally we had Kirk, which was instinct, Spock, which was logic, and McCoy, which was human emotion, and replaced human emotion with love, with Uhura. Now, that's not a bad idea, and that certainly drives 90% of all movies these days. Love drives a lot, to some degree. Love and fast cars. But for Star Trek, it made it a bumpy ride. Because Star Trek doesn't know how to deal with love. If you go back through all of the other movies of Star Trek, they've never figured out love. No. I mean, like, the closest they ever came to is maybe Insurrection. And that, they really mishandled that. Star Trek IV, there was Catherine Hicks in there as Dr. Gillian something. And even then, she just, like, kind of disses on Kirk. So Star Trek doesn't know how to deal with love. And if there is someone who Kirk or Picard or any of those people fall in love with or Sisko is in love with, you better watch out because they're dead. They are not going to make it, okay? Edith Keeler, Miramani, boom, they're gone. Sisko's wife, boom. And now there's sirens coming. Maybe for the cats and the dogs and the bugs in here. Okay, so we have Kirk with his problems and McCoy sort of taking care of that. Then we have sort of another secondary plot line with Mr. Spock, Zachary Quinto, who discovers that Prime Spock, Leonard Nimoy, has passed away, which then prompts him to want to leave Starfleet as well to help out with the Vulcan homeworld or establishing the 10,000 Vulcans who are still alive. So we have this sense, and of course, McCoy, he doesn't want to be there anyways. McCoy doesn't want to be on outer space. He's just kind of doing it just because he's friends with Kirk. So we have our big three not wanting to be on the ship. They're tired. They're fed up with it. And if we're going to complete that with Uhura and the love situation, they're fighting. Uhura and Spock are fighting. We can put that to the side. They didn't mishandle that. That was a pretty good... I think, again, if we're talking about love in Star Trek, I think the way they handled this love spat is better than the previous two episodes where they handled Spock and Uhura. It was just such an odd fit. It was so shoehorned in. This is the first time it felt organic, and it's the only time they actually haven't, like, you know, really made out or you know, canoodled together, I guess. Sure, I'll stick with that. I stopped the tape. I don't want to deceive you guys. I got to let you know that I have been stopping the tape a little more here and there because I'm still trying to do a good job at this. This isn't just me, like, you know, bullshitting it through and just saying, "Oh, it was a good show." I'm actually trying to form some cohesive thoughts here as I'm being surrounded by bugs. I'm trying to justify you listening to this. I'm trying to give you nuggets of information that you can then pass on to your friends saying, "Oh, well, you know, the troika of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy was sort of unended when Uhura became part of it." That is good stuff. That's stuff you're going to take to your sci-fi friends and say, "Oh, insightful. This is what I do for you. This is what I do." And what does the Enterprise do Well, it's space docks at the U.S. Yorktown Space Station. This is a crazy, weird, it's like those puzzle balls you get now. They're clear, and you have to get the little marble through all the different things. I don't know who the hell built this, but they decided it'd be a really good idea to go ahead and build a big space globe, a big snow globe ornament, and fill it with all sorts of regular-looking buildings that, like, somehow defy gravity, because that's a good idea, right? So it looks like a big star inside of a snow globe, and gravity is crazy, and if you hit a home run, it's going to go and circle around and go through someone's window, like, in 15 years, because gravity just, like, has no rhyme or reason there. There's artificial gravity in all sorts of weird configurations. But it's basically, it's like the USS set piece, USS third act, basically. Because if you look at it from a physical standpoint, why that space station exists and why it has a big glass dome around it so you can... I don't understand what's going on in that space station, but it looks cool. So, okay, I buy into it. I buy into it. And it's here where we get our missions. You know, basically, Kirk, he can go ahead and become Vice Admiral. That's going to happen. And Spock can leave because he got that information from Vulcans right as they were disembarking. And Sulu does meet his husband and his child, and so we get that subplot for a microsecond. You know, there was such a big deal about Sulu being gay and having a gay, you know, relationship. Man, that was like 11 seconds of our lives that, you know, it could have come and gone without them even mentioning it. But they did mention it. They did make it a thing, and it's like, you guys, why was it? If you had said nothing, it would have been far more powerful because you don't need to say anything about it. We get it. It's 2016. We don't care about that stuff anymore. Just do it. Just do it. Don't worry about it. But instead, like, oh, well, we're going to have a big subplot about, you know, Sulu being gay and George Takei didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. You know, again, Paramount has got in front of their own feet too many times, and the result has not been positive. We'll talk about the box office in a little bit. But it's here we start becoming a little more traditional. I mean, I liked where we were going, and then we sort of get this kind of this alien girl who shows up who doesn't speak English until the Universal Translator kicks in. I actually kind of like the way they have the Universal Translator translating her words into English as opposed to us just like pretending like somehow we understand what she's saying and the Universal Translator is translating in real time and making our eyes believe that, you know, her mouth is moving in sync. This was actually a little better that they had the little chip on her, you know, lapel that would translate it so there'd be a little bit of delay. I dug that. But she gives us our story where we have to go off to that planet. Oh, I'm going to look up that planet right now. Planet Ultimid. Ultimid. Altoid. On planet Ultimid, deep inside the nebula. Now, the Yorktown was built right outside this really menacing nebula. I mean, you can see it. You can see a nebula right there. I mean, there are asteroids slamming into each other as we speak. It is filled with space dust and all sorts of horrible things. And someone at Starfleet thought it'd be a super cool idea to build a space station, a giant space station, right next to it. What a good... Let's go ahead and build it right here. Let's build, you know, the Pentagon next to the sinkhole, because that's a good idea. It's not a good idea. I'm being facetious. But it provides us with sort of a geographical understanding of where everything is. Like, oh, the bad guys are in that. So they go in there, you know, with this crazy-headed woman. And, you know, I'm going to give them props also for really, like, doubling down on making all the crazy-headed aliens. You know, in the original TV show, you just kind of give them a little bit of a different color skin or put them in a rubber mask or give them antenna. That was the extent of being an alien. The Klingons, they were just sort of like copper skin dudes with beards. Romulans, you know, pointy ears. When we got to Next Generation, from that point on, it was just dudes with bumps on their foreheads. But they went for it in this. They really went for the great prosthetic makeup. And I guess Jeff Bezos was in there and Danny Pudi. So I don't know why you put these high-ranking people in all this makeup. I mean, who cares? Who would know? I mean, oh, sure, Danny Pudi's in there. The whole casting community's in there. Why not? How would you know? But they went above and, shall we say, beyond the call of duty in creating all these great creatures. From what I heard, there was 50 of them, I guess. I think they made like a beat that there was like 50 aliens, one for each year of Star Trek. Okay, you know, hats off to you. Good job. But they certainly cash in all the big-headed aliens. Now, as far as aliens that were like strange, you know, like tripedal, you know, cat women stuff, they didn't quite get to that. But whatever, they made leaps and bounds from creating these creatures. So they go to this planet, and of course they're attacked by this giant swarm of alien ships. And you know what? I liked that. I liked the alien swarm of ships as opposed to the big bad spaceship, as opposed to making a bigger ship. You know, it's so easy just to build a bigger Death Star, right? I mean, Star Wars is kind of in that point of situation right now. It's like, well, they build a Death Star. Then they build a bigger Death Star. And now we put the Death Star on a planet. I mean, we get it. You guys like Death Stars. They don't work. In every iteration, they get blown up. And in every iteration of Star Trek, they keep on trying to build bigger and bigger ships to fight the Enterprise. I will point out in Star Trek 2 that the Reliant was smaller. So bigger is not better necessarily. And this was a good villain as far as a spaceship. This swarm of thousands upon thousands of ships that the Enterprise wasn't prepared to stop. You know, it sort of reminds me a little bit about how, you know, after 9/11, the U.S. military was not prepared for insurgency warfare. They were not prepared for small house-to-house warfare. They're prepared to fight the Soviets. And now they're fighting this small arms, IED kind of war, and they were completely unprepared. And that's sort of what it was like with the Enterprise. The Enterprise had no defenses against these tiny ships. They were just carving it up. And so it was a good set piece. Now, Justin Lin did a good job on this movie. I'm going to say right there, I think he did a good job. Yes, there were Fast and Furious moments in it, but it was good enough that I was okay with that stuff. You know, I mean, you got to pay the piper. And I will not disparage him for putting in action sequences, especially since in the original Star Trek, every single act break, before every act break, they had to have something cool like a fight or a phaser being fired or something like that. The network demanded some sort of action. So you got to pay the piper. You've got to keep the 18 to 25-year-olds thrilled about this stuff. So a good set piece. They destroy the Enterprise. Everyone's been kind of on that. In the context of this episode, in this movie, because it's destroyed early on, I can be okay with that because it is a major plot point, and the whole idea is that they have to get off this planet. Now, Generations, they just kind of crash-landed the ship, and nothing happened. And they also had a saucer crash here in this one, so very similar to that. But, I mean, if you're going to crash something, if you're going to destroy the Enterprise, it has to be worth something. Just like when they destroyed it in Star Trek 3. I mean, it was in the middle of the movie. It has to mean something. And, again, Kirk and company were stranded on a planet with no way out. Okay, and it's here that we start, you know, we're definitely past the first act into the second act. Now they're on the planet. I know I stopped and I moved forward. I don't care. I don't care about this. This is going to be a very segmented episode. It's not going to be linear. It's going to be a little asymmetrical as far as I'm concerned. But that's okay. That's all right. Because I'm still trying to put all this together. And especially since now that the saucer section has been, you know, crash-landed on the planet and the cast has been scattered everywhere, there's multiple storylines. We've got Uhura and Sulu, you know, traipsing around trying to send messages. We've got Kirk and Chekhov running around, bumping into the bad guys and trying to get the thing, the Abernoth. The Abernoth sounds Scottish, right? Give me the Abernoth. And then we also have Spock and McCoy just surviving. They're just surviving. They're just doing a buddy film. So we're definitely spread out quite a bit all of a sudden. But that's okay too, because finally we can pair off all of these people and get to know them a little bit better. And especially, and you know where I'm going with this, it's Spock and McCoy. Now, Kirk and Spock work great. Kirk and McCoy work great. But the hidden variation is Spock and McCoy. Think about the Tholian Web. What a great episode when the two of them had to work together in order to bring back Captain Kirk. That's third season. That shouldn't have worked, but it did. We really get that when the two of them are forced to work together, you get magic. Because here's, you know, the two girlfriends vying for the attention, you know, the wife and the mistress, and all of a sudden they have to work together. That's great. What a great idea that was. I love that. Scotty also meets Jayla, who was, that's a play on Jennifer Lawrence. in Winter's Bone or whatever that movie was, and they just never changed the name to Jayla. It's Jayla. You know, I was okay with her. She didn't upset me, but she didn't thrill me. She, you know, a badass girl who's living on her own. We've seen this a bunch of times. You know, no one's breaking new ground with that, but that's okay too. You know, it's fine. It's fine. I didn't mind it. It didn't upset me. We have Krall now as well. Krall, Diana Krall, jazz singer, and his cohorts who are running around sucking the life out of people, like in that movie Life Force. I don't know if you saw that movie a long, long time ago. It's called Life Force. You don't have to rent it. It's like space vampires who suck people's life energy out. But he's there, and he is trying to get the MacGuffin, the Abernoth, because it's going to do something with something. You know, bad guys, they have ridiculous plans. They're always trying to do something that's so convoluted. He's trying to get this device to destroy Starfleet because it emits this weird gas that eats everything. I don't know. Man, that stuff, you know, like Ultron and the Avengers 2, what was he trying to do? He was trying to lift up a part of a city and slam it into, man, I mean, just blow it up, man. This is not hard. We have seen this since like James Bond, that we still fall into that trope of these villains with incredibly complicated motivations. Now, if we go back to Star Trek 2, Khan's motivations were not that complicated. He wanted to destroy Captain Kirk, and he wanted Genesis. Now, the problem was he had two motivations, and one messed up the second one. Now, this is similar to Krall, I guess. Well, Krall just wanted to get the mysterious Abernoth. So the Abernoth is in two parts because they sent them into space into two. Why not 50 parts? Why not break them into 1,000 parts and send it to the sun so no one finds it? But instead, this ancient civilization took the Abernoth, broke it in half, and sent it to two different parts of space. And somehow the Enterprise wound up with one half of it, and he has the other half. So once they're joined, then he can release the toxic space gas and destroy the Federation. You know, Krall, he's kind of all over the map. Krall is kind of a problem. As the years go on, we will start to dig into Krall and what his motivations were, whether or not they were worthy. And maybe in with future, they will be. But my sense is that we're going to say, wait, what is he doing again? He's trying to create discord in the Federation. And we don't quite know why, but we will later on. All right, so we have some second half shenanigans with Karala being a double agent. We all kind of saw that coming, right? She was kind of part of Krall's coterie of bad guys, and you know, there's a third bad guy which Jayla has to defeat because he killed backstory. Okay, so we start reassembling the team, and then we start going for a very fast and furious jailbreak, because if they can get the crew, they can get them all on the USS Franklin, which Jayla happens to be on. And there's a weird piece of footage that we keep on seeing over and over again. What's that all about? Meanwhile, Krall gets a hold of the second part of the Abernoth, which in the best part of the film is hidden in this girl's head, her face hugger head. She has a weird ass head that has like fingers in the back that extend out like the facehugger from Alien. What in their evolution would create a bipedal creature that looks almost identical to humans, but would necessitate weird spider fingers coming out of the back of your head? What is that for? Is that for mating? Is that for catching bugs? I mean, I could certainly use that now if there was one behind me. God, I'm looking behind me. No, I'm okay. But I mean, what is that for? I mean, what is that? How you shake hands in that planet? I mean, is that to keep stuff there? Is that to keep like a juice box? Why would you have crazy fingers in the back of your head? I don't understand it. But I loved it. I love that girl. She's going to be on the new Supernatural spinoff series. I looked it up. I wanted to talk to her, but she may be too important for this podcast. We're going to work on that, but because she was adorable. And then she dies, which is stupid. That's just dumb. I don't like that part. I loved her. I wanted her to be a part of the bridge crew because she is awesome. And she could be like, she could be talking to Kirk. And then like as she's looking at him, she could be doing stuff behind her back with her fingers on the controls, like, yes, Captain, I'm doing that right now. That would be so badass. We needed her, but instead Krall had to display what this mysterious like gas did, this mysterious whatever the hell it is. It's this swarm of nonsense. It's this swarm of plot that kills her off because we can't kill off Uhura because she's, you know, under contract to do another movie if this one goes and blah 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 blah. So they kill off, I think her name is Ensign Syl or something like that. She's adorable. She's adorable, and I loathe and lament her passing, but it's important to see what Krall is going to do. And he also eats some other crew members. He also makes them, like, you know, shrivel up like raisins. And then he starts to change, which is weird, right? We're like, oh, what's that all about? He changed, right? Is it me? No, he changed a little bit. And now we come to the jailbreak moment. The jailbreak moment. And this is one of two moments which I'm going to have a little bit of a hard time with. Chris Pine must love motorcycles. There must be something in his contract where he has to drive a motorcycle. Because he's driving a motorcycle in this movie, and he's in the new Wonder Woman film. And in the trailer, he's driving a motorcycle, probably from the same time frame, too. I mean, they both look identical. Did he, like, drive it, like, from, you know, wherever they shot it in Canada here, all the way down to Australia where they shot down there, or something like that? Was that his thing? We all lamented and loathed the motorcycle that was in the trailer for Star Trek Beyond. We were all going, gosh, I hope this isn't going to be a big deal. And truthfully, it wasn't a horrible thing. But instead of one motorcycle, we got like 50 motorcycles. 50 William Shatners on motorcycles. I'm sorry, Chris Pines on motorcycles. Driving all over the place. It was almost like they're trying to troll us intentionally. Like, oh, you don't like this motorcycle? We're going to give you 50. Of course, they're all holograms in this kind of insane, ridiculous plot that, like, oh, I'll distract them by driving a motorcycle around having all sorts of doubles. And that's always such a weird thing. Like, oh, you won't shoot me because why? What if they do? I mean, they're all trying to shoot all these dudes on motorcycles. They're going to get to you at some point in time. How does that plan work if they shoot you and you're dead, and then all of a sudden there's like 50 dead motorcycle guys in holograms? Like, well, they're all dead, so I guess we got the right one. It's fine. It's we've left some of the conventional logic. Now we've gone to like flight of fancy, basically. There's a lot of fighting. You know, there's a lot of punching and kicking, and Jayla gets her revenge on dude who killed her father for something or other. And then they all beam to the Franklin, and then they fly off. And they have to stop the swarm, but the swarm is too, there's too much, and they don't have the right phasers to do it. And here comes part two of the, well, they're going to do this, and we're going to have to be okay with it. You know, there's a line from the Beastie Boys which says, I can't stand it. I know you planned it. And damn it, if they didn't plan it, if they didn't set this up in the first movie and then put it in the trailer and just pave the way for this. Sabotage. Sabotage. You say sabotage, I say sabotage. Look up Captain Kirk saying sabotage or William Shatner saying sabotage on the internet. He has a really funny outtake where he won't say sabotage. He says sabotage. It's something weird. I can't remember how he says it. It's really weird. It's a fun little thing. But they laid the groundwork for it, didn't they? They have this long scene. It's like, well, we're going to have to broadcast some sort of frequency to the ships. Well, what kind of frequency? It has to be a VHF. So it's like a radio station, right? But the frequency, what is the music? Well, we have to do a special tone and blah, 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 blah. And they do all that, lay all that track just so they can play Beastie Boys Sabotage. Just so J.J. Abrams can sit in the theater and say, ha, I like those guys a lot. But you know what? They pull it off. I mean, it. My eyes rolled into my head and escaped my body and rolled down to the marina and tried to escape. And then they came back because it's like, you know what? If you're going to lay that amount of track to get that one beat and it's in the third act, I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to give you a hall pass on that because, you know, why not? You've done enough good things up to this point in time. They had some really nice Spock and McCoy scenes there where they were, I don't know where they're going. They were just kind of stuck in a cave and they had to go someplace. We got to get the others, but like he's dying and blah, blah, blah. That didn't make a lot of sense. They just had to travel. But they had done many good things before that. So I was going to forgive them. And I did. I forgave them. And then we make the big discovery, either before or after that, that Krall is actually, what is his name? Bartholomew? It's Balthazar Edison. Balthazar Edison. Who names their kid that? Oh, why don't we name him Balthazar Edison? Good job, hologram of Thomas Edison. Where did that come from? He'll serve on board the Franklin. Sure, all sorts of electricity connotations here. But it turns out, and this, if you haven't seen the movie, it's too late now, but there was this weird reveal where, like, deep into the third act, it's revealed that this guy was actually a member of the crew of the Franklin. Him and crazy head girl who was deceiving, and a guy who killed Jayla's father. All three of these guys were part of the Franklin crew, who were basically decommissioned after the Federation was created. And this is sort of an interesting subplot. I mentioned that earlier, the idea that, you know, the military wasn't ready, the Enterprise wasn't ready. And here we have another situation where it almost reminds me of after the Berlin Wall came down, there was this peace dividend, and so many weapons facility plants and so many ships were decommissioned because we just didn't need them. We weren't going to fight the Russians anymore. And so we have these guys here who now, you know, they thought that they were being abandoned. They fell through a wormhole. I had to read on Wikipedia. Fell through a wormhole and felt that the Federation had abandoned them. That's a big leap of logic there. But, and then they are on this planet where they can use the powers to stay alive by eating people, and it changes their face, and they're going to get the eyebrows. So there's a lot of weird-ass stuff going on here, right? You can't put Krall's story together too tightly, right? Because it is a puzzle made of many different puzzle boxes, right? They just, we'll just clip that on there and clip that on there. And I wish it would have been earlier in the show, because the idea of warriors who have been decommissioned, warriors which are no longer useful, is an interesting original series idea. What do you do with those people, and how do they feel when they're no longer useful? But instead, they tucked into the third act and made it kind of a weird reveal. And we all kind of had to live with that, and we did. And we had an interesting little battle scene with Spock and McCoy flying in their ship. Good stuff. And then we get this last kind of, you know, I can forgive the Beastie Boys thing. I can forgive, what was the other thing I could forgive? The motorcycles. But it was egregious to have Kirk and Krall having this strange third act set piece in zero gravity floating around the Yorktown like they're doing some sort of weird American Gladiators fight on ropes. They're in zero gravity and the Abernoth is floating around and there's a ventilation system and they got to get this and that. It was superfluous. We didn't need it. I will always be upset at Star Trek III to a degree that they had Kirk and Commander Krug fight at the end, because they didn't need it necessarily. Khan and Kirk didn't need to fight at the end. They didn't need to have a physical fight. They didn't need to have a testosterone battle. Kirk had beaten him. And how wonderful would it have been to have Kirk's crew be the victors. Go off and stop those guys. You did it. I'm in command. This is what I do. I don't need to fight the bad guy one-on-one. Mano-y-mano or mano-y weird-faced dude. All I need to do is command my crew. That's what the lesson should have been, is that I don't need to do everything. My crew can do it. I don't need to step beyond my duties. I can let them do it because I trust them. Because for the past 3 years, they've been doing everything I've asked them and more. That's what the beyond should be about. It's not about him like floating around in space on some wire work, you know, green screen somewhere in England fighting Idris Elba. Did I say that right? I don't know. Fighting that guy who, you know, wasted. I just gotta say, I mean, his backstory was all over the map, and he just growled and shouted stuff. You know, cast somebody else. But we didn't need to have Kirk do that. I would have been so much happier if at the end, after Spock and McCoy destroyed the last two ships or whatever it was, or maybe you destroyed Krall's ship, we just have Kirk on the Franklin, just smiling, just saying, I did it, we did it. And then we cut to the end, to the wrap-up. You know, it's fine. It is what action movies demand these days, that we have this final battle. But we don't need it for Star Trek. We don't. Star Trek 4 didn't have it. Star Trek 5 didn't really have it. Star Trek 6 didn't really have it. Star Trek 7, it had it. Not very good. Star Trek 8 had it. It was okay. Star Trek 9 had it. Not very good. Star Trek 10 had it. Not very good. Star Trek 11 had it. Star Trek 12 had it. Not very good. So you can see that never pays off. And yet they feel the necessity to do it over and over again. Why? I don't know. Because some executive in Paramount says, oh, they should fight, right? You get the last two guys to get together and fight, right? Quarterbacks don't fight during football games. Baseball pitchers don't like duke it out towards the end. They don't have them like doing a pitch off or you know, throwing touchdowns. I mean, I guess there's, well, I'm getting beyond what I should be talking about. Afterwards, we have the wrap up. Kirk stays, Spock stays, everyone stays, and they decide to keep on going. And the film ends. There's no tag. Good movie. Good movie. A solid B for me. B or B plus. Everyone who's been responding has definitely been giving it much better reviews than I have, but I'm picky and I'm hard on this stuff, but I enjoyed it. So it's good. The bad news is it hasn't been doing very well in the box office. It has performed worse than Into Darkness and worse than the 2009 movie. And that's troubling. I wonder sometimes if Star Trek is meant to be a movie. Simon Pegg said the same thing just today. He said, maybe Star Trek is better as a TV show. The movies were an extension of the TV shows. They were, you know, big two-hour episodes, basically. They allowed the production to do more. They had more money. But this is putting the cart before the horse a little bit. Star Trek never started out as movies. They started as TV shows. And as good as these are becoming, and this movie finally started making the right strides by identifying the characters and really solidifying the characters, I can't help but wonder, is this the right series? Is this the right time to do a Star Trek franchise? I don't know. But certainly the box office has been soft, and I think Paramount's going to look at it really long and hard and crunch the numbers. Now, they already announced that Chris Hemsworth is going to be playing Kirk's father again in the sequel, but that doesn't mean a lot because they announced Fantastic Four sequel, and then they're never going to do that. They can announce as many sequels as they want to this stuff, but if it doesn't perform in the box office, they're never going to make another one until they decide to make another one, but this franchise might be closed off. And that would be too bad because the first of the new Trek of the Kelvin universe was pretty good. The second one was pretty bad. And this one I think is the best of the bunch. I don't mind saying that. I think this is the best of the bunch. And as my friend Tony said, this is probably the best Star Trek film we've had since First Contact. And that was a long time ago. And I would hate that we'd have to wait a long time to get to watch Star Trek again, the big screen. But we might have to, because we might have to go back to the farm leagues, so to speak, and go back to television and build back up the franchise from there. It's going to be tough because CBS and Paramount don't like each other very much as far as movies and TV, but they're going to have to get over this. Mom and Dad are going to have to love each other again. They're going to have to work it out because we want to see characters that we love doing things in grand ways on the big screen. Or we want to see characters that we love really facing interesting, difficult challenges on a weekly basis on the small screen. That's what we want. It's not too much to ask for, right? We just want the world, the universe, give it to us. Give it to us. Give me Genesis. All right, so I didn't expect to go 48 minutes deep on this, but I did. That's okay, though. That's okay. I needed to talk about this. I needed to get all this out. I need to set the table for how we're going to talk about this for the next few years. But I got to stop. I'm going down to the Las Vegas Star Trek convention for Thursday and Friday. If you're getting this podcast and you're in the area and you want to hang out or say hello, hit me up on Twitter, I guess, at Mike McCafferty. Stop by the Facebook page and I'll post all sorts of cool things of me and Ryan Nagata, George Edelman, Alex Edelman, And who knows who else there. I'm going to try and get a ton of interviews while I'm out there. I'm going to try and meet all these great Star Trek people. I'm lamenting the fact that I can't be there on Saturday for the big costume contest. But you know what? My son's in Greece. My son's doing the musical Greece. And I did that decades ago. And I want to see him do it. And his opening night's Friday. I'm actually going to miss his opening night. But I'm going to see him on Saturday and Sunday in four shows. And so that's going to make up for it. But I had to go. I had to go to Comic-Con. I have to go to the convention. And I have to come back. And what do you have to do? It's simple. Yeah, just keep on listening. Subscribe on iTunes and hit me up on Twitter and all that sort of stuff. Because this is the best damn Star Trek podcast you're going to listen to. Forget about all those official ones. This is the one, because what other podcast would link it back up with more damn piano music, huh?
Beyond the rim of the starlight. Star-clustered reaches, love, strange love, a star room teaches.
Every time you play a song, it's different. Every time you see a movie, it's different. This is what we're here for. This is why Star Trek is great, because it's always different, and it's always cool, and we can always talk about it until either you or I die. This is the 50th anniversary. My name is Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek!
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I
don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My